Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 289, Miscellaneous Articles and Update. This is being recorded on April 8th of the year 2001, just like the update on the JFK assassination that you heard in number 288. Once again, that was from the concluding item in the previous broadcast, was from an issue of High Times magazine. Now, that's a marijuana advocacy publication for which I do not hold a brief. They have done some good investigative reporting, and I would note that that sourcing was from an upcoming book by Daniel Hopsicker about Barry Seal called Barry and the Boys. It connects Barry Seal with the same Civil Air Patrol unit that was commanded by David Ferry, the focal point of Jim Garrison's investigation until he was murdered or, quote, committed suicide, unquote. And it also connected Seal with another member of Ferry's unit, Lee Harvey Oswald. And later there was a photograph taken of Seal, Watergate burglar, Bay of Pigs operative, and Kennedy assassination disinformation agent Frank Sturgis, a.k.a. Frank Fiorini, photographed with Felix Rodriguez, an Iran-Contra operator and an anti-Castro Cuban, and also in a report that Barry Seal may have flown the assassins out of Dallas, or some assassination personnel out of Dallas. In this broadcast, for the record number 289, we're going to be visiting updates on various stories and also introducing some articles that are of importance. Research credit on the following story goes to a member of the listening audience. This concerns the recent arrest of an FBI agent, Robert Hansen, as a pro-Soviet and later pro-Russian spy. What was not mentioned in most of the press accounts concerning Robert Hansen was the fact that he was part of a secretive lay Catholic order called Opus Dei, whose founder was an ardent supporter of Francisco Franco, the fascist dictator of Spain. A number of Opus Dei members served in Franco's as ministers in the Franco government. Opus Dei was also heavily involved with the rise of Pope John Paul II. And we took a look at Opus Dei in part of the RFA series about the shooting of the Pope in May of 1981. That series was done in May of 1986, and in programs number 17 and 21, we took a look at Opus Dei. Whatever the possible significance of the Opus Dei membership of Robert Hansen is not something that has received a lot of discussion. One exception to that was an article in JINN, J-I-N-N magazine, that is put out by the Pacific News Service, and this can be accessed from the Pacific News Service website. That website is https://www.pacificnews.org/JINN/stories/6.31/01030-5-spy.html. This article was headlined by JINN Magazine and the Pacific News Service. Was FBI agents' true loyalty to Opus Dei? This is dated March 5th of the year 2001. It's by Yoichi Clark Shimatsu. The article reads, "The mystery within the mystery concerning Robert Hansen, accused of spying for the Soviet Union for more than 15 years, is simply what motivated him to do it. With no signs of pro-Soviet ideological commitment or extravagant spending, the answer may lie in Hansen's membership in Opus Dei, an ultra-conservative Catholic organization." PNS commentator Yoichi Clark Shimatsu is former editor of the Japan Times Weekly in Tokyo and has reported on the Aum Shinrikyo sect. "Intelligence experts and congressional committees are puzzled over what motivated FBI agent Robert Hansen to spy for Moscow in the past 15 years. Money seems to offer no clues because Hansen lived in an ascetic style. Nor is there yet any evidence that this happily married man fell into a honey trap involving a coy Natasha. The search for a motive is complicated by the fact that his colleagues say that Hansen was fiercely anti-communist and a devout member of Opus Dei, an ultra-conservative Catholic organization. He was a regular parishioner of St. Catherine of Siena Church in a Virginia suburb of the capital, where an elite congregation, which includes Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, attend traditional Latin masses." We're going to take a look at Antonin Scalia, the most right-wing member of the Supreme Court that recently appointed George Bush to be president, in our next article. Continuing with this article, "It might be reassuring to believe that Hansen acted alone, but if that is the case, he would likely have repented and confessed all. The opposite reaction, his stony silence, indicates something other than the sins of a prodigal son. Hansen's one-word explanation for his treason, according to an FBI affidavit, was loyalty, unquote. It may well be that his loyalty to Opus Dei and, by extension, the Foreign Service of the Vatican State hold a key to the mystery. Opus Dei, Latin for Work of God, is a secretive lay group within the body of the Catholic Church with more than 80,000 members worldwide. As the only personal prelature in the Church, it is an entity unto itself, separate from the diocesan structure. Founded in the late 1920s by Spanish priest José María Escriva de Balaguer, Opus Dei assumed a political role from the start, openly siding with the Franco dictatorship. Its members served in cabinets while Spain was allied with Hitler and Mussolini. Opus Dei floundered in the wake of World War II, but regained impetus under Pope John Paul II after providing crucial support for his papal candidacy. In the Polish Pope, the group found a champion willing to back its harsh stance against abortion, birth control, its crusade against communism, the push for Catholicism as a state religion, and war on left-leaning liberation theologians within the Church. It may seem paradoxical that Hansen would spy for the Soviet Union, a moral adversary and indeed a satanic force in the eyes of Opus Dei. During Gorbachev's Glasnost era, however, there is evidence of behind-the-scenes collaboration between the Vatican and Moscow. In particular, Vatican Secretary of State Cardinal Agostino Casaroli, a powerful Opus Dei supporter, pursued a policy of reaching out toward Moscow with the aim of gaining Poland's release from the Warsaw Pact. Rivers of money, much of it provided by Bill Casey's CIA, poured into Warsaw and Moscow, and the Vatican found ready support from the U.S. because the security establishment under President Ronald Reagan was packed with conservative Catholics, including Casey, Richard Allen, and William Clark. Hansen's most damaging activities in FBI counterintelligence coincided with these years, 1985 to 1989. Secrets from America's intelligence vaults could well have been part of the quid pro quo in the late Cardinal's dance with Moscow. Certainly, the Vatican has had no qualms about violating American sensitivities. Indeed, it seems to reflect a Eurocentric triumphalism. The papal encyclical on labor rights slapped rampant materialism, that is, the immoral United States, as the other great evil afoot in the world. The Vatican's political work with Moscow paid off handsomely with the independence of Catholic-dominant Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Ukraine, and later, from Moscow's nominal ally Yugoslavia, of Slovenia and Croatia. All the while, Hansen kept up the flow of U.S. secrets to Moscow. Why might a conscientious Catholic be accused of betraying the FBI's Russian recruits to the firing squad? Hansen has spoken of his schoolboy fascination with a book about Kim Philby, Britain's notorious turncoat spy, a claim flawed by the fact that the Philby conspiracy was published after Hansen graduated from high school. But Hansen may well have read Jean Le Carré's 1974 Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, based on the Philby saga, in which a high-ranking mole betrays his fellow agents in order to advance his career inside the British intelligence bureaucracy. As Moscow rolls up their spy rings, his rivals, one by one, lose their chances for promotion, while the double agent becomes the golden boy headed for the pinnacle of power. The plot of Tinker Tailor bears a disturbing resemblance to the recent chaos inside U.S. intelligence. Did Hansen clear the path to the FBI directorate for his fellow Opus Dei member, Louis Free? This possibility cannot be dismissed, nor should reluctance to interfere with a religious organization prevent a probe into Hansen's ties within Opus Dei. In nearly every case involving a secretive sect like the Branch Davidians or Aum Shinrikyo, law enforcement authorities have erred on the side of acting too slowly. For the faithful, the response to the Hansen affair should not be limited to sermons about a lost sheep tangled in Satan's snares. Opus Dei models itself after the Counter-Reformation, appears to be repeating the worst mistakes and appears to be repeating the worst mistakes from that chapter of church history. As the church became engrossed in the fates of nations, its moral certitude against Protestant dissent was lost. The institutional paranoia of the Inquisition gave rise to the secret police of Cardinal Richelieu, who were at the service of the state. That attempt to remold the state into the image of the church resulted in its very opposite, the French Revolution. In the aforementioned RFA series about the shooting of the Pope, we dealt with some of the Vatican power politics, and in February of 1992, I updated the role of conservative Catholic organizations and also Bill Casey's CIA in the destabilization of the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. It should be noted that even though the Pope himself was very conservative, and even though he was very close to Opus Dei, which helped to elevate him to his position, the Pope himself, a Polish national, was working on a rapprochement with the former Soviet Union on a number of different things, even prior to the Gorbachev era. The Pope did not want an outbreak of war or an invasion by the Soviet Union in Poland in response to the Solidarity Crisis, and the Vatican and the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union, had also found common ground with regard to support for a Palestinian state and recognition of the PLO, as well as for nuclear disarmament and the avoidance of a nuclear Holocaust. None of these things sat particularly well with the Reagan administration, and the available evidence suggests very strongly that it was reactionary and fascist elements in the West that shot Pope John Paul II, elements connected to the P2 Lodge, the intelligence community, their evidentiary tributaries running through the Stibom arms for drugs ring in the direction of the Iraqgate and Iran-Contra scandals, and again in RFA 17 through 21, as well as number 34, and numerous For the Record programs, we updated the Pope shooting. I would note that in For the Record program number 98, we noted that the Pope's bodyguard at the time of the shooting and the person who had much to do with actually the physical handling of the Pope at that on the site of where he was shot and who shielded the Pope was a fellow Alois Esterman, who was recently assassinated. He was murdered by a colleague in the Swiss Guards, and he was a member of Opus Dei. So again, whatever the possible significance of Robert Hansen's role in Opus Dei, or his membership in Opus Dei for his spying on behalf of Moscow, and whether or not there is any significance to the presence of FBI Director Robert Free in Opus Dei, I do think that the ruminations by Clark Shimatsu there are worth taking in mind, or worth taking into consideration under the circumstances. In that article, you heard reference to the fact that Robert Hansen attends the same church as Antonin Scalia, the most right-wing of the Supreme Court judges, and a man who had two of his sons working for the law firm that represented the Republican Party in its arguments before both the Florida and federal Supreme Courts, one of a number of conflicts of interest with regard to the Supreme Court's elevation of George Bush. One of the major changes that is taking place in the United States concerns the fact that the Bush administration has been making some fundamental changes with regard to the American judiciary. One of those was discussed in a Guardian article, that's the British Guardian. This also was researched for us by a member of the listening audience. This comes from the Guardian's website at www.guardian.co.uk/Bush/story/0,7369,463144,00.html. This article is by Julian Borger, or Borger, B-O-R-G-E-R. It's from Monday, March 26th of the year 2001. Again, this is carried in the electronic or on the website of The Guardian. That is Guardian Unlimited. This article is headlined Judgment Days, D-A-Z-E, subtitled The Battle for Control of the American Judiciary is Being Waged by Federalists in the White House Who Represent a Radical Right-Wing Agenda. The article reads as follows. It does indeed sound like the vast right-wing conspiracy Hillary Clinton complained about at the height of the Monica Lewinsky affair, except that the Federalists are not a secret society. They meet openly and even have a website. I would note that the Monica Lewinsky campaign events against Bill Clinton involved, among others, Theodore Olson, now the Solicitor General Designate of the United States. That post is often referred to as the 10th Supreme Court Justice. It was Theodore Olson who argued the case for the Republican Party before the chief counsel before the U.S. and Florida Supreme Courts. Continuing. Speaking of the Federalists, but members played a leading role in both President Clinton's impeachment and in the Florida legal offensive which brought George Bush to power. A leading light is the Supreme Court judge who did most to steer the decision in Bush's favor. As a group, they are poised to transform the American legal system. The Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy plans to unleash a legal counter-revolution which will turn back the clock on affirmative action, environmental standards, and other forms of government regulation. Founded in 1982, the group set as its goals the ideological conquest of the nation's law schools. 2 decades on, it has achieved an extraordinary degree of success. The Federalist Law School chapters now offer graduates a faster route to the top through clerkships in high-profile chambers and a powerful career network than the mainstream professional body, the American Bar Association. They scored their greatest triumph last week when President Bush stripped the ABA of its role as a vetting agency in the appointment of federal judges. The ABA had first been assigned the task by President Eisenhower as a means of setting minimum professional standards for the judiciary around the country. But in the eyes of the Federalists, the ABA has merely been enforcing a status quo built around the New Deal and civil rights legislation introduced by Democratic administrations. The Federalists have now taken the ABA's place in all but name. In President Bush's first week, a task force was set up in the White House to rush through nominations for the 100 out of a total of 862 federal judgeships in appeals and circuit courts. The courts settled great debates, Roe v. Wade over abortion, Brown v. the Board of Education over desegregation, not to mention Bush v. Gore over the presidential election. So it is hard to exaggerate the importance of these judicial appointments. Almost every member of the White House vetting panel is a Federalist. Many are veterans of earlier campaigns, such as Brett Kavanaugh, the young lawyer who served as chief investigator for Kenneth Starr, President Clinton's inquisitor and nemesis, and another member of the Federalist Society. Mr. Starr, in turn, got the job of independent counsel from David Sentell, a conservative circuit judge and early Federalist member. The lawyers acting for Paula Jones in her sexual harassment suit against the president and for Linda Tripp, who handed over secret tapes of Monica Lewinsky, were both Federalists. Other members of the White House legal team played prominent roles in the Battle of Florida last autumn when Bush lawyers succeeded in halting a manual recount of the vote and drove the dispute to the Supreme Court, which famously handed victory to George Bush. The Bush cause was argued by Ted Olson, the head of the Washington chapter of the Federalist Society, who is now Solicitor General. It was supported most fiercely on the Supreme Court by Antonin Scalia, one of the moving spirits behind the formation of the Federalists, and a regular attraction at the Society's seminars and retreats for ambitious lawyers. The Federalists represent one of two radical right-wing agendas, the other is Christian ultra-conservatism, which hitchhiked on the Bush campaign and now influence policy out of all proportion to their support among the public at large. The Society draws inspiration from a libertarian interpretation of the writings of James Madison, the Founding Father, who occasionally fulminated against the power of central government. The Federalists today see the evil hand of centralism in any form of federal regulation, whether it be affirmative action for minorities, rules against sexual harassment, or environmental emission standards. They believe the legal profession is dominated by a form of orthodox liberal ideology which advocates a centralized and uniform society, unquote. During the first 100 days of the Bush administration, the influence of Federalist ideology has been apparent in the rapid dismantling of workplace safety standards, the decision not to impose carbon dioxide emission standards, and the plans to open up the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling. The fact that the Energy and Interior Secretaries Spencer Abraham and Gail Norton are both senior Federalists, no doubt played a role. James Bopp, another Florida veteran, is leading the legal fight against campaign finance reform. The battle for control of the judiciary is not over entirely. The Federalists in the White House have been working through the night for the past few weeks in a frantic effort to find 100 ideologically acceptable judges before a senator, probably the 98-year-old Strom Thurmond, dies and robs the Republicans of their one-seat majority. Even before that, the congressional approval of Federalist nominations are not a foregone conclusion. Moderate Republicans shrink from the society's ideological purity, but to the extent that the Federalists succeed, the U.S. will become a very different country. Yes, indeed. And in that context, I would note the following. This is a column, an op-ed column in the New York Times of Saturday, March 31st of the year 2001. It's by Anthony Lewis. It's Dateline Boston. It's headlined, "The Feeling of a Coup." It reads in part, "We are learning something these days about the power of a willful president. Without a popular mandate, George W. Bush is making radical changes that will have long-term consequences for this country and the world. He is making them in a hurry, and for the moment there are no checks or balances to stop him. Day after day, headlines tell us of fundamental policy reversals. Mr. Bush spurns the global effort going back to the first Bush presidency to reduce global warming. He calls off talks with North Korea about its missiles, casting doubt on the whole attempt to ease relations between North and South Korea. He proposes to rethink U.S. aid programs that help dismantle former Soviet nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. A string of Bush administration decisions has halted steps to protect the environment." And this goes on, skipping down. "This is the most radical administration in living American memory. I use the word deliberately. Today's right calls itself conservative, but it is not that. Conservatives want to conserve. That is why Teddy Roosevelt started the national parks and the conservation movement. George W. Bush and his people are driven by right-wing ideology to an extent not even remotely touched by even the Reagan administration." And I would note that the Washington Post noted that this was the most conservative administration in American history. Ralph Nader supporters, take note. We're going to conclude with a look at a very important European business group, and this is not one of the loci of power that generally gets discussed much in analyses of world political doings, but nonetheless, this is a body that deserves to be focused on in terms of analyzing world business dealings and political dealings. It's called the European Roundtable, or European Roundtable of Industrialists, or ERT. A write-up of this group was discussed and was presented in the Financial Times of Tuesday, March 20th of the year 2001. This particular article is by Paul Betts, B-E-T-T-S. It's titled, "The Quiet Knights of Europe's Roundtable," and it reads, and is subtitled, "A secretive group of influential industrialists sets out grand visions of the continent and seeks to influence the thinking of political leaders," writes Paul Betts. This article reads in part as follows. "The building could almost have served as a set for Alfred Hitchcock. Tucked away in an inconspicuous corner of Brussels, the nondescript block has no porter, just an intercom that lets visitors in through two glass doors in a small Spartan hallway leading to two lifts and a staircase behind a locked door. The offices of the European Roundtable of Industrialists, or ERT, are on one floor, understated, and functional. They seem somewhat incongruous for an organization whose 46 members are the chiefs of European companies, with a combined annual turnover of more than 950 billion euros, or $865 billion, and a workforce across the world of nearly 5 million people. The offices of the European Roundtable of Industrialists, or ERT, you would not imagine that this place saw the conception of a strategy that is set to be assessed by Thursday's European Council meeting in Stockholm. That strategy, adopted by European governments and the European Commission at a council last year in Lisbon, drew largely on broad ERT recommendations. It exhorted the European Union to become, quote, the most competitive and dynamic, knowledge-based economy in the world, capable of sustainable economic growth with more and better jobs and greater social cohesion. That may sound like big-picture stuff, but then everything about the ERT is grand. Even its carefully guarded invisibility conveys the quiet confidence of power. Secrecy has merely strengthened its critics' conviction that the ERT is, quote, a shadowy lobby group that has for the past 15 years exerted an iron grip on policymaking in Brussels, unquote. As the Guardian newspaper described it in a 1999 report, a particularly critical study entitled Misshaping Europe, unquote, which was published 7 years ago, even suggested, actually beginning again, secrecy has merely strengthened its critics' conviction that the ERT is a shadowy lobby group that has for the past 15 years exerted an iron grip on policymaking in Brussels, as the Guardian newspaper described it in a 1999 report. A particularly critical study entitled Misshaping Europe, which was published 7 years ago, even suggested that, quote, the political agenda of the EC, as the EU was then known, has to a large extent been dominated by the ERT, unquote. And while the 5,000 or so lobbyists working in Brussels may occasionally succeed in changing the detail of directives, the report says, quote, the ERT has in many cases been setting the agenda and deciding the content of EC proposals, unquote. Skipping down. Founded in 1983, it grew out of the Groupe des Présidents, formed in the 1960s by a very select and small number of European business tycoons led by Giovanni Agnelli of Fiat. They met once or twice a year to exchange ideas over a few bottles of good wine. Under the imports of Per Gyllenhammer, then chairman of Volvo, this group was transformed in the 1980s into a larger, more active big business lobby. Its membership has since grown from the original 17 to 46, and its secretariat has moved from Paris to Brussels. It remains very exclusive, dominated by big European manufacturing groups such as Siemens, Renault, Fiat, ThyssenKrupp, Philips and Bayer, and multinationals such as Unilever, BP Amoco, Royal Dutch Shell, and Nestle. And it continues to be governed by strict club rules. For instance, membership is personal, not corporate, and by invitation only, unquote. Members are asked to leave if they fail to show up at the two annual meetings or do not help to establish working groups or to draw up position papers. So again, the European Roundtable of Industrialists, or ERT, the movers and shakers behind the EU, and an organization about which we do not hear very much. This is from the Financial Times of Tuesday, March 20th of the year 2001. I've made allusion to other tapes I've done over the years. Those are available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire. That's one word, Spitfire. They're located at P.O. Box 1179, P.O. Box 1179, that's in Ben Lomond, California, 95005. The email address for Spitfire is mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. By the time you hear this program on most of the member stations, there will be a detailed and annotated description of For the Record Program 289 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. Sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, is archiving the For the Record segments on Real Audio. You can visit their website for recent For the Record programs at wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word, DaveEmory. There are also back and more distant, time-wise anyway, For the Record programs available on http://archive.wfmu.org/archive/capital D capital X/. That concludes For the Record program number 289, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This is being recorded on April 8th of the year 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.